Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and the time is now just 11 o'clock. Coming up on the Boo at 11:30, Radio Zine presents Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and the world's reaction to Trump's Jerusalem Declaration. Tonight at 5 on the KBOO Evening News, an in-depth segment featuring author Bobby Arellano and his book, Havana Libre. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. If you want to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Coming up next, it's Intersections Radio. Sarika talks to Niti Chanani about her celebrated graphic novel, Pasmina.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the holiday fundraiser for Portland Homeless Family Solutions on Tuesday, December 19th at the Doug Fir in Portland. Portland bands Foxy Lemon, Camp Crush, and The Get Ahead will play bluesy rock, new wave pop, and country-fied soul to benefit Portland Homeless Family Solutions, which helps families with children find housing. Again, that's the holiday fundraiser for Portland Homeless Family Solutions on Tuesday, December 19th at the Doug Fir, 830 East Burnside Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. Niti Chanani is an artist, a graphic artist and illustrator specifically, and the force behind the website Everyday Love Art. This was inspired by her desire to produce an illustration every day, which celebrates beautiful and lovely moments. She just released her debut graphic novel, Pashmina, which is about an adolescent Indian American girl, Priyanka, who finds a magical Pashmina shawl in her mother's luggage. When she puts it on, she's transported to a fantastical version of India, something from the Incredible India Tourism Company. And this motivates her to learn more about her family and her heritage. This graphic novel also tells the adventures of other women who work to empower themselves and achieve new successes upon finding this magical Pashmina. Niti has survived a difficult childhood and the loss of her baby during her first pregnancy. These experiences in part motivated her life in illustration and art. Niti joined me on Skype and we talked about South Asian women in the arts, her new project, and the unexpected journey that led to Pashmina. This is Intersections Radio. Well, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Thank you.
First of all, again, congratulations on your debut graphic novel and for it being sold out on Amazon. That's pretty excellent.
Yeah, it's all good. I mean, it's just 2 months out, so everything is very new and very exciting. So it's been a really amazing ride.
Let's talk about Pashmina. What was the inspiration and the development for this story?
So the inspiration for the story actually is rooted in kind of finding my parents or opening my parents' suitcase when I was, I don't know, tween, is that what they're called now? my parents went to visit India, and when they came back, I remember opening my parents' suitcase and seeing all these things inside that were familiar but also unfamiliar, and kind of the smells and the colors and these objects that all felt really otherworldly, but at the same time, part of my world. And I remember that experience and that feeling of wanting to go to this place and wanting to learn more about it. And it left an impression on my mind. And I think because of that strong response to their suitcase, I kept that kind of experience in my memory. It made such a strong impact that I thought it would be the good basis of a story. And so the root of it is very much that experience from when I was younger. And so in the book, Priyanka Das, the lead character, finds a suitcase, and inside of it is a magic pashmina. And so I think the root of it came from that, and then how it developed over the course of time was very much just writing and writing and writing and rewriting to get to a place where I felt like I had a strong story.
Sure. And one of the things that I really loved about this, about the plot, is that it's not just that she finds this magical pashmina and it transports her. It's that for the other women who find this, it transports them in an empowering way. It's not just a fantasy. It's like, it's these women empowering themselves and seeing possibility and working to achieve it.
Yeah. So the root of the story really is, I try to figure out what the theme or the, not message, I hate that word, but really what the theme of the thematic element in Peshmina is women's choice and women's power, and having power over their own lives. And so the Peshmina doesn't just stay with Priyanka. We see the book centers around her, but we also see it go, and I won't, no spoilers or anything, but it does go from Priyanka to another character. And again, it doesn't necessarily make the choice for you, but it allows you to see that there are options, and what you decide to do after you see, you can visually see and experience your life in that different choice. What you do with that knowledge is obviously up to you because it's your choice, but it's really this shawl or this pashmina needs to be there for these women to be able to really envision themselves having a different kind of life.
Right. Something has to give them the opportunity for possibility. Another really powerful character is Priyanka's mom. She's a single immigrant mother, and that too from India. Talk about her. Talk about developing her character.
Well, a lot of her character in no short way is based off my mom, but also in Priyanka herself is also based off me. So that relationship dynamic, of course, I drew upon my own experiences in my own life. But I did a lot of work as well after using the base of the characters. And this is how I like to kind of approach my writing and my character bases. Even in my new graphic novel, I'm doing the same thing where I have the base is either somebody I know really well or somebody in my life, and then doing the work in my writing, in my pre-writing, to make the character unique. So I have a base of kind of information and quirks and character from real life, and then certain things that I definitely develop and work on to make it more appropriate for the story and more my own.
Obviously, there are other characters in the story, like the mom's sister and the auntie and uncle who are family friends. And I really was kind of drawn, like, I wanted to know more of the histories or the lives of these characters, and the mom's history, especially the maid. I was wondering, are we going to get to experience any sequels or prequels? Because I was like, we want more. Or are you kind of putting this to bed?
Moving on, there are probably about at least 3 to 4 stories that I kind of bounce around in my brain and do some writing about. And so I've never really, at this point, I'm not thinking about anything in a series. Okay. I have one book that I'd like to explore as a series, but that's way down the line. And I think it's very high concept, and I'd have to partner with the right publisher who would see my vision. So, and I need to get there. I feel as though I learned a lot through making Peshmina. I learned a lot through going on the road and promoting Peshmina. And I still have a lot to learn, but I also know that the stories that I am bouncing around, I know what makes sense to do next. And what makes sense to do next is actually this book that I'm working on with my husband called Jukebox. It was just announced, and it's about two cousins who find a jukebox that takes them back in time. So no, Pashmina will not have a sequel, but there is more to come. It's just going to be a different story.
Sure. I was just going to ask you about your next project.
It's two Muslim American cousins who find a magical jukebox that takes them back in time. And, you know, just like I talked about in the theme for Pashmina, for me, a lot of the inspiration of this book, and I'm writing it, co-writing it with my husband, mm-hmm. although I'm going to do all the drawing because this is our running joke, is he can't even draw a circle. he's an audiophile. Our living room is probably, I would say, 25% vinyl records.
Wow.
So we listen to a lot of vinyl. Music has been this theme of conversation within our relationship and prior to our relationship within our friendship forever. We've been together for 15 years. And so it almost made sense that we would end up doing something around music together. And so the story is about these cousins who find a jukebox that takes them back in time. And there's a mystery involved. They're searching for somebody. And the characters are tweens. I'm not really sure if I'm using that term correctly. But they're, you know, they're pre-puberty. And they're really trying to find this person. But beyond that, they're also learning about the intersections of music and history and how impactful music has been within history. And so that's kind of the theme that I wanted to explore through working on this book.
As a music nerd myself, I thoroughly look forward to this. When can we expect it to be published and out for all of us?
It is slated for 2020, okay. Which seems, I think, to people who hear that as very far away, but it's due at the beginning of 2019. So for me, I'm already in the kind of panic stage of, oh my God, how am I going to do all this work by that time?
What is it like to work with your husband, especially producing, you know, another graphic novel?
Well, I mean, we work together on a lot of different things, but there was a period of time in between jobs. So I was, not to get into it too much, but I was pregnant with my first child, and we unfortunately lost the baby. And after that, we both basically decided that we needed, you know, time to recoup from that, and he ended up leaving his job and he came to work for Everyday Love Art. Mm-hmm. And during that time, we realized that it's really great to be around each other all the time, but also very challenging. Mm-hmm. Because I have very specific ideas of what I want to do and how I want to do them. And it was, I think, mostly me being in a situation where I had been working on my own independently for a long time. And then there was, you know, Nick. I think that we work really, really well together on ideas and concepts and stories and those kinds of things. We've been bouncing around together for a long, long time. But in the day-to-day of actually business stuff, it wasn't working out so well. So we ended up going back to work, which is good. Also, at that point, you know, our income kind of nice. Halved. So that was also really rough. We work really well together as long as, and I think this is key for any relationship, really, as long as we're maintaining a certain amount of respect for each other, you know, and each other's ideas. And so we try to keep aware of that and make sure that, you know, we're giving each other the space to listen to each other, even though we might not agree all the time.
Let's talk about representation in literature. There are so few graphic novels that illustrate the experiences of our South Asian communities, particularly that are created by South Asian American women. I can think of, including yourself, I can think of like two or three off the top of my head. What do you think is the reason?
You know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I first started pursuing my career as an illustrator, you know, it was about a year before I felt like I really got good and started having people request prints. One of the things that I drew a lot is I drew a lot of, you know, Indian illustrations or Indian themes, Indian clothing, and all a lot of mixed race couples. And I started to get a lot of messages from both people who are in mixed race marriages and people with South Asian background. And they were just thanking me for representing our lives, our imagery in art in a way that they hadn't seen before. And so I think that the other thing that I started to notice is that a lot of women and men and parents would contact me and say, you know, I liked to draw and I really liked art, but I ended up pursuing, you know, biotech or, you know, law. And I think this was before I became a parent, in conversation with some parents, they said, you know, by seeing you do this work, I really want to encourage my budding artists, you know, and put them into art classes and those kinds of things. And I think a lot of it is based off of both a history of opportunity, a history of a focus on education and a focus on achievable success, right? And and kind of like understandable success. And so, I mean, a lot of folks, I don't know how far back your family goes, but I think by definition, first generation, even though I was born in India, but I came here when I was 4 months old. Mm-hmm. And so our history doesn't, you know, we're very close to that, having come here with nothing and then needing to achieve something. And so I think that when you talk about the arts is such a gamble. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that's very easily understood as a pathway to success, as a pathway to financial comfort. And so I think within the community, it's just not supported as a result of those things, as a result of a lot of factors that could shift the tide in any way. And then, you know, you land in this stereotypical place of being a starving artist. And so I think it's really challenging our community to understand that, yes, it is possible that you end up in, you know, a financially insecure place, but that can happen really in any industry.
Exactly.
So, you know, I think that it really is a community awareness problem, and I think that's probably why we don't see as many South Asians going into the arts, because it is such unfamiliar pathway to success. It doesn't mean that it's not there. It just means that it's not seen.
Yeah, I agree with you. I can't blame immigrant families for saying, I want my children to not struggle how I did, and I want them to have stable income. But I agree, you know, nowadays there's nothing is terribly stable. There's a lot of gamble, and no matter what we go into.
Yeah, and that's exactly how I feel. You know, I can't blame my family or any family coming from poverty into a system, into education system, and a situation where they feel like there is a lot of opportunity. And no matter what people say, there is a lot more opportunity here to push their children to do something that they feel like is a sure bet, you know?
Well, giving some very specific examples of this, what were some of the challenges and barriers you experienced in trying to get Pashmina published? What made it worth it?
Well, part of the challenge with it, actually, you know, initially I had tried to pursue, which I'm very happy to not have done, was a memoir.
Oh, okay.
I had written a memoir called Hinglish, which I've just started to talk about actually a lot, and because it will never see the light of day, and it was not very good, but I put it out to agents, actually. So I wanted to land a literary agent, and that was how I landed my agent, because she saw something in it. I still don't know what she saw in it, but she saw something. But I had sat through a post-art school and thumbnailed out over 200 page memoir. And so I think that at the very least, she saw that I was able to start and finish something and tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a pretty I had a really traumatic childhood, and so a lot of that was in that memoir. And, you know, there was still a lot of work that needed to be done. And at the point that I had presented it to her and I signed on with my agent, and I had a couple other agents who were interested in representing me. So it did its job. From all intents and purposes, I will never publish it, and it will be never a path that I pursue, but it landed me my agent and also showed me that there was a lot of work to be done within the book, but I wasn't willing to do it because it was reliving and rehashing a lot of stuff, and I didn't really want to live in that permanently. And so it was a few years before I started to think about a different kind of story, and in the Pashmina idea and the base of the story came back to me, and I started writing it and pitching it in the help of my agent. And I think that the challenge within making Pashmina wasn't so much, and very surprising to me, was it wasn't in selling it. We had interest in it from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate in that my agent asked me what publisher I wanted to work with. And I said I would love to work with First Second because they had made some of the books that I loved and some of the books that I was looking to as examples of where I wanted to be and the kinds of stories I wanted to tell. And so when First Second made the offer, I was ecstatic, but they made it with the stipulation that I would need to revise. And so before I actually signed a contract, I was on, I think, my eighth draft of the manuscript.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I think the biggest challenge was really working the story and learning about all of these things that, you know, as a new writer, I felt kind of out of my depth, and you know, I felt there was a lot of internal struggle within that process of, you know, am I good enough to do this? You know, am I able to understand it and extrapolate the things that they want me to do with this story? And, you know, I'm rewriting it for the eighth time, and can I really change it that much? And what are the things that I actually need to change? And so that process was pretty intense, but I'm really happy with how it turned out. And nothing about the story from the very beginning, like if you look at the first draft to the eighth draft, what it did is just kind of tweak it at each turn. And so the base of the story never changed. It's just that the elements of it got stronger.
That's a process. I didn't realize that this was initially a memoir of your life. And so you've mentioned a few times that this memoir will never be published. And you're fine with that.
Yep.
But now you've kind of piqued my curiosity. I mean, you said that you had this traumatic childhood, and if you don't want to talk about it, I completely respect that. But
well, what I can say is that some of the similarities with at least Priyanka in feeling like an outsider very much were my experience. But beyond that, you know, I just had a really complicated family life, and I don't want to get into it. But there was just what I can say is that I suffered a variety of abuses within my family, and that became very difficult to kind of operate both in the two cultures that I was growing up in, and then to be in a situation where I was constantly holding on to secrets. And so the secrecy really, it kind of, I think, became really difficult because it wasn't just one, it was multiple.
I'm sorry you experienced all of that. It's amazing how this process works. I have one last question. If you put on this magical Pashmina, what would you see?
I think I would see this. I would see my life as this. I remember it's very much tied to something somebody asked me recently. I think it was on a panel. If you could tell your younger self one thing, what would you tell them? And it's that it gets better. And I think that that's, you know, we came from, like I said, I came from a troubled past, and we were very working class. We always had issues around, like, money, and there were definite trust issues within the family. And so there was a part of me that never felt like, though my life would change and it would be happy. And I definitely feel that growing up, there was a part of me that really wanted so much to be happy and to have a happy life, but I didn't have that. And because I didn't have that at a young age, I found it very difficult to think that that would be something that wasn't just an illusion on TV and in movies. And now I'm in a place where there are moments where I'm just sitting, and I was just talking to a friend of mine about this, and there's this beautiful banality of my life. It's very mundane, but it's so beautiful. It's just we're making a puzzle every evening. My daughter, she's obsessed with puzzles, and so we sit and do the same puzzle sometimes three times in a night, and that's very mundane, but there's something so beautiful about it, just to see a little child process this in a space that's surrounded by love. And so if I put on a pashmina when I was younger, I would have liked to see this, you know, this life full of love, that's just very ordinary. You know, we're pretty normal people, but we have a lot of love, and I feel like that makes it really special.
Nithi Chinani, thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
Thank you for having me.
That was my guest, Nithi Chinani, the author and illustrator of the graphic novel Pashmina. Check out everydayloveart.com to learn more. To listen to the podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. Visit the same website for previous episodes of this podcast, and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
I'm Eileen with the Oregon Cultural Trust. Community radio means access to music, news, and programming for everyone. That's why I support KABU with my contribution every year. It's also why I match that gift to the Oregon Cultural Trust. When you make a gift to KABU, make a matching gift to the Cultural Trust by December 31st. Then you can use the cultural tax credit next year to reduce your state tax bill. It's true. And it's also how KABU supporters guarantee access to cultural programming in Portland and all around the state. Visit culturaltrust.org today to learn more before December 31st.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Philip Weiss of the Middle East news site Mondo Weiss, who discusses how President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital will impact people across the Middle East and further damage already frozen Israeli-Palestinian peace talks. Jefferson Morley, Washington correspondent with Alternet, who explains why he believes the Trump White House consideration of a plan to set up a private intelligence network is both undemocratic and dangerous. And April Taylor, a sustainability scientist with the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma, who talks about how indigenous communities are building capacity to confront the impact of climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the eve of a pivotal international conference on migration in Mexico, the Trump administration pulled out of talks on the United Nations Compact on Migration. The UN is negotiating a new framework to address the plight of refugees and find solutions to the large number of job seekers migrating out of the developing world. The Global Compact was launched by the UN General Assembly in September 2016, which approved the New York Declaration for Refugees and Migrants. The declaration sought to enhance international coordination on migration. A compact on migration is a top priority for new UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, in announcing the Trump withdrawal from the compact, declared, "Our decisions on immigration policies must be made by Americans and Americans alone. We will best decide how to control our own borders." In response to Trump's pulling out of the compact, journalist Karsten von Namen wrote a column for Germany's public broadcaster Deutsche Welle, stating that agreements made by the United States are no longer worth the paper they're written on. He warned that the president risks isolating the U.S. for the sake of his own fans and his own ego. Violence escalated in Yemen's three-year brutal civil war as the Iran-backed Houthi rebels killed former President Ali Abdullah Saleh. Saleh had switched sides in the war and recently allied himself with Saudi Arabia. Earlier, the former president had joined forces with the Houthi that controlled most of Yemen. Saleh was president of Yemen for over 30 years and was forced out of power during the Arab Spring. In recent days, Houthi rebels had openly clashed with Saleh's fighters for control over Yemen's capital and largest city, Sana'a. After Saleh's death, Houthis maintained control over Sana'a despite increased Saudi-led airstrikes. Yemen, the poorest nation in the Middle East, is now in the midst of a humanitarian crisis with over 8 million people on the brink of starvation and dangerous outbreaks of cholera. The situation has been triggered in part by a Saudi blockade of food and humanitarian aid. Thus far, over 10,000 civilians have been killed during the nation's three-year civil war. Although Washington has supported the Saudi air campaign against the Houthi rebels with weapons and refueling for its fighter jets, the White House has begun pushing for more access to humanitarian aid and has warned Riyadh that concern in Congress over the humanitarian crisis in Yemen could constrain future U.S. assistance. Texas populist Jim Hightower and former presidential candidate Bernie Sanders' political organization, Our Revolution, ran a barnstorming tour through Texas to boost prospects for progressive victories in the 2018 election. Tyler, Texas, a blue-collar city, used to support Democrats like Hightower in the 1980s and 90s before the town started to lose thousands of good-paying factory jobs at Goodyear and Carrier Corporation. In 2015, Tyler and its suburbs voted for Trump over Hillary Clinton by a 3-to-1 margin. Across Texas, Democrats haven't won a statewide race since 1994 and continue to lose congressional seats. Now, inspired by recent Democratic victories in Virginia and New Jersey, Our Revolution is making a commitment to revive the state's populist tradition. The group has targeted three Texas congressional seats whose district Hillary Clinton won last year. Our Revolution organizers are offering a populist, pro-worker, tough-on-billionaires message that Texas Democrats used to embrace. The group is also employing a strategy to run in places where Democrats aren't supposed to have a chance, drawing in frustrated Democrats, independents, and members of the largest political group in the state, non-voters. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On December 6th, U.S. President Donald Trump announced his recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, setting off protests in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian West Bank and in nations across the Middle East and around the world. Trump ordered the U.S. Embassy to be moved from its current location in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem in the coming years. The unilateral declaration on Jerusalem broke with 70 years of American foreign policy, which held that the final status of the disputed city should be determined by Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. Jerusalem, the home of revered Muslim, Jewish, and Christian holy sites, is viewed by Palestinians as the future capital of a Palestinian state. Although Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu maintain that the U.S. Jerusalem Declaration is simply recognition of facts on the ground, people around the world express their opposition to the move with passionate protests. While leaders of the Palestinian Islamist group Hamas called for a new intifada or uprising, Saab Erekat, the Secretary General of the Palestine Liberation Organization, declared that Trump had disqualified the U.S. from any role in future peace negotiations. Your reporter spoke with Philip Weiss, co-editor of the online Middle East news site MondoWeiss.net. Here he assesses how President Trump's Jerusalem Declaration will impact people on the ground in the Middle East and its effect on the already frozen Middle East peace process.
Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu went to Europe, tried to sell all the European nations on following suit, saying that Israel's capital is Jerusalem, and they all said, no way. So far, Trump is pretty alone here, and he does break with the tradition that Bill Clinton and George Bush and Obama observed, which was, we're keeping the embassy in Tel Aviv. In Bush and Clinton's case, they both ran on the promise to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and then wiser heads prevailed. In Trump's case, he has followed through on a campaign promise that he made to the Israel lobby group AIPAC. As disruptive as it is, it's not as if it doesn't reflect the reality, which is that Israel has devoured Jerusalem. It's been devouring Jerusalem since 1967, when to claim the eastern half of the city after this 1967 war. The world has regarded that as an occupation. The United Nations has repeatedly called it an occupation, and Trump's decision, it's a huge blow to the two-state solution, but he has blown away the hypocrisy of American presidents, American administrations, insisting that we're not going to move our embassy there, but on the other hand, we're not going to do anything to stop Israel from devouring Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. And the damage to the two-state solution is what Israel and the Clinton administration has done, what the Bush administration has done, what the Obama administration has done. And Trump is, in a sense, sort of simply acknowledging the failures of the American government to do anything to stop the Israeli settlement project.
As you said, Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insist the U.S. move here in recognizing Jerusalem as the Israeli capital is just a recognition of facts on the ground. But they maintain that this move by Trump will not derail U.S. efforts to initiate a new round of peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. How much credibility does that statement have?
It has no credibility whatsoever for me. And in fact, I think that's one of the things that enrages, is most angering about this announcement, the claim that you can pursue a peace process when you have already ceded central issues in what is to be negotiated to one side. And that is what Trump did. That actually, of course, is what previous administrations have done. But when Netanyahu says that, when he says, hey, this in no way forecloses a two-state solution, all he's trying to do is to keep Israel from being delegitimized in the eyes of the world. Because Israel wants it both ways. It wants to control all the territory, and yet it wants to claim that it's working toward a two-state solution. And when one prop of that sort of delusion is removed, i.e., you're not working toward a two-state solution, then the world has to move on and say, hey, this is apartheid. There's a struggle for equal rights going on here. Israel controls all the land. And the last thing that Netanyahu wants is for such a sort of international South Africa delegitimization campaign to begin. So he has to say, no, we've got the two-state solution alive. It's alive and well. And in fact, his cohort in the United States, the Israel lobby, the right-wing Israel lobby, is saying, no, is two-state solution is still right on the table. And they do this even as they know that they're not going to make any effort to bring that about. Promises that were made in Oslo and in the Oslo process a quarter century ago have been demolished, and the Palestinians have only seen less and less sovereignty over those years.
With Trump's declaration on Jerusalem, what are the repercussions, in your view, for the United States and Israel in terms of political and diplomatic isolation?
the violence that we've seen crop up in places like the occupied West Bank and other regional capitals. What's the blowback for Trump and Netanyahu?
One has to begin by saying that I'm sitting in an armchair in New York, and hopefully we would not suffer violence that's going to flow from this, but there will be violence flowing from this, and people will lose their lives. A lot of people will be hurt because of this decision. That being said, I think that the international diplomatic consequences of this are actually extremely positive for Palestinians. I don't think Palestinians have ever had as much prestige internationally as they do right now, because you see even mainstream American voices, journalists who have tended to side with Israel again and again and again, looking at this situation and recognizing the Palestinians are getting screwed. And European countries are clearly very angry about this. Federica Mogherini, foreign secretary of the EU, made it clear that Netanyahu, we are not acknowledging this. None of the European states is going to move their embassy to Jerusalem. And there's a great deal of sympathy for Palestinians that I think will translate into some real moves on the Palestinian people's part. I don't know quite what entity that will be. It's the BDS campaign, the boycott campaign, has been fostered by this move. Whether the Palestine Liberation Organization will take its case now to the International Criminal Court, that might be one of the outcomes of this. The PA might collapse. But we are seeing an edifice of 25 years of lies of the Oslo process, in which the Palestinians have been deceived again and again and again, and in which the world has been told, no, they are not a partner to peace. That edifice is collapsing. And now we see that the Palestinians, they got screwed the other day in Washington, and it just lights up all the times that over the 25 years that they have been lied to. And so I think that there will be a lot of people coming to their side, countries coming to their side, international movements coming to their side, and that will be the good consequence of this decision.
That was Philip Weiss, co-editor of the online Middle East news site, MondoWeiss.net. Find more news and commentary on Trump's Jerusalem declaration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Intercept and BuzzFeed recently reported that the Trump administration was considering a plan to establish a private, off-the-books intelligence network that would run counter-terrorist propaganda efforts around the world. The proposal was developed by Eric Prince, the founder of the Blackwater private security firm that had been found responsible for massacres of civilians while under contract to the Pentagon during the U.S. war in Iraq. Prince, the brother of Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, had reportedly teamed up for the project with his former CIA colleague John McGuire, the company Amintor Group, and Iran-Contra scandal figure Oliver North. According to The Intercept, the network would provide CIA Director Mike Pompeo in the White House with a global private spy network that would circumvent official U.S. intelligence agencies. Sources say the plans have been pitched to the White House as a means of countering deep state enemies in the intelligence community seeking to undermine Donald Trump's presidency. Your reporter spoke with Jefferson Morley, Washington correspondent with Alternet, whose recent article titled, "The Last Thing America Needs is Trump Armed with His Own Private CIA," which examines the private spy network proposal. Here Morley explains why he believes privatizing U.S. intelligence operations is both undemocratic and dangerous.
There have been these stories that have been circulating since the summer about Eric Prince looking for a way into U.S. policy and offering his services. The first form that the story took was an offer to help in Afghanistan, where Prince has an extensive network of contacts through his security company that was once known as Blackwater. The name has now been changed several times to escape the notoriety of Blackwater's actions in Iraq, where they were involved in several massacres, killing of non-combatants. So Eric Prince is trying to escape that past while drumming up new business with the government. His proposal for privatizing secret operations in Afghanistan was rejected by Defense Secretary James Mattis, but this story that came back and that was reported on by BuzzFeed and The Intercept and Alternet regarded a different proposal to, but a similar concept of offering private security companies services to the CIA. And the reports were that specifically that they were looking for, that they would provide help with rendition, right, which is a fancy way of saying they would assist the CIA in capturing, kidnapping people and bringing them to the United States to face some kind of justice. So, you know, these are, we've had episodes in the past where the CIA want, the president wants the capability to do something that the CIA says it can't or won't do. So it's not unprecedented, but the plans that are being proposed now are unprecedented. I mean, the idea that a private company would go and do a rendition of foreign terrorist suspects, that's never been heard of before. And one of the CIA people, retired CIA people who I talked to, said, you know, that's just a non-starter, you know, that the idea that you would have a Blackwater for rendition, it's kind of extraordinary. But, you know, we live in extraordinary times, and, you know, you'd think such a thing wouldn't be feasible, but, you know, we've seen a lot of unfeasible things happen. So, you know, I take it very seriously.
Jefferson, what was the initial response of the White House? And I note here that their first reaction was to declare some kind of fantasy and fake news, but later they hedged a bit and didn't quite dismiss it out of hand. Maybe you could review that for us.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, the White House understands that these are very controversial ideas, you know, bypassing the CIA, creating an intelligence network that responds, you know, only to the president and is not publicly funded. I mean, there's a lot of alarm bells that are going to go off. So they're saying it's fake news, but they're not denying that this company, Amintor, run by a friend of Eric Prince, has indeed proposed these actions. So they haven't really denied the facts of it. They've just tried to discredit the message and say somehow that it's fake. But as far as we know, it's still under consideration, you know, but now that there's been a light shown on it, you know, they may be reluctant to go ahead, given that, you know, it may create political problems for them.
What's been the reaction, if any, that we know of from U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agencies, about this story of a private off-the-books intelligence outfit that Trump wants to report directly to him?
Well, there hasn't been any official reaction from the CIA, you know, and they're in a tough spot because the CIA has only one client, that's the president. So if the president says, I want to do things this way, the CIA is going to be loath to tell him no. So the institutional pressure within the CIA is going to be, you know, to go along with it. A CIA guy who I talked to, retired officer, distinguished, not part of the current CIA, you know, thought that the idea was crazy. Why would you have a CIA doing something, you know, that the CIA didn't want to do, you know, or couldn't do? His thought as an intelligence professional was that it was just a bad idea, you know, quite apart from the politics, you know, whatever political goals the Trump administration might be seeking. And the idea of running an intelligence service to create a private competitor, it's not the way to go. We have a CIA to accomplish certain tasks. To create another entity to do that, either you're trying to evade the law or you're trying to evade public accountability. But, you know, whatever it is, it's not necessary and it's not a good idea. And we saw in Iran-Contra what the results were. Massive lawbreaking.
That was Jefferson Morley, Washington correspondent with Alternet, whose recent article is titled, The Last Thing America Needs Is Trump Armed with His Own Private CIA. Morley's new book is titled The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. Find links to more articles on Trump's private spy network proposal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. We'll be right back. The theme of this year's annual American Public Health Association conference, held in Atlanta last month from November 4th through the 8th, was climate change and health. The keynote speaker was an indigenous woman from northern Alberta, Canada, who's helping to lead the fight against tar sands extraction. Several of the conference panel discussions dealt with indigenous community concerns regarding the changing climate and actions they're taking to confront these changes. For centuries, Native Americans have relied on natural resources to sustain their families, communities, traditional ways of life, and cultural identities. This relationship with both land and water makes indigenous people and cultures particularly vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the American Public Health Association conference and spoke with April Taylor, a sustainability scientist with the Chickasaw Nation who works at the South Central Climate Science Center in Norman, Oklahoma. In the following interview, Taylor describes her job assisting 68 tribes across New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana manage and plan for the many environmental impacts of climate change, including issues such as tribal water rights, sea level rise, flooding, droughts, and wildfires.
The way I explain my job is I do three things. One, I'm a matchmaker. So I am out engaged with tribal staff of various types, and I matchmake them with climate scientists and researchers to work together on projects and go after funding to plan for the impacts they're seeing in their communities already for climate change and what they might see in the future. The second aspect is we do trainings. We build tribal capacity. We've done 32 trainings in the last four and a half years. And they're on all sorts of things, including grant writing, data and tools, and how to find the right information and resources to developing the plans for their communities. And then the third aspect is we do youth outreach, so promoting Native students in STEM fields, creating our next generation of tribal staff.
You mentioned, I think, four states that you cover, and some of them I know have had huge climate impacts, including, you know, what is being described as the first U.S. climate refugees, a small tribe in Louisiana.
I just wrote a piece for the National Climate Assessment on the Louisiana tribes. We've done quite a bit of trainings and networking down in Louisiana. It's really interesting to see them doing this relocation in their own way. They're moving their entire community. It's really cool to see that they want to do that, and it's sort of bringing them closer together. A lot of those communities, you know, they've lived on the coast for a very long time and were forced out to those areas.
This is Île de Saint-Charles? Did I get that right?
Charles, yeah. Okay. But there are other communities out there as well. There's Point Aishane. Chittimacca is out there as well. Chittimacca is really leading the way in the scientific aspect and mapping out their sea level rise and making their plans. Huma tribe is out there as well, the Huma Nation, and they're very active and aware of climate change. And we have the Coushatta tribe. They're going to be impacted as well, even though they're very far up on the mainland right now. I work with more of the scientist or planners type of people. It's not uncommon that we get, especially in those communities that are being impacted now, that you get leadership involved. Our last training was in May, and it's really interesting. I mean, you get community members, you get Native church people that come in for these trainings because they're interested. They want to know what's happening and what are they dealing with.
Is it mostly sea level rise and flooding? Are there other issues related to climate change that you're seeing in the tribes you work with?
Drought. Several of the tribes are doing drought planning. Wind River just finished theirs. Chickasaw Nation is waiting for the final approval to finish ours. And they're really leading the way and taking the leads before the states and before what's required. They're not required to do drought planning, but they're doing these things. Wildfires is another huge one. Loss of water resources and tribal water rights is a big one. So we're not seeing the stream flows or the snow melt. These communities are seeing these changes. We're seeing changes in species and how species are being in cultural significant species. and how they're changing already. And so some of these species that they rely on, what's happening is what we call, and there's an indigenous phenology network. And phenology is basically the timing of the seasons and when things change. And so they're seeing some of those changes happening, you know, months earlier. And so they're trying to figure out if what that means for their culture, for the communities. Do we change the ceremony and things like that? For my tribe, we have a butterfly restoration project as well. So there are 7 tribes doing butterfly restoration, trying to help the species adapt.
That was April Taylor, a sustainability scientist with the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. Learn more about how indigenous communities are building capacity to confront the issues of climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KPOV in Bend, Oregon, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
KBOO Portland.
This program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and support from All Classical Portland. Presenting for a fifth and final time, Mark O'Connor's An Appalachian Christmas, featuring the O'Connor Band with Nancy Ives. Alan and Laura Vizzuti open on Friday, December 22nd at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. An Appalachian Christmas features seasonal carols infused with bluegrass, folk, and Americana. A holiday tradition for all ages, tickets at allclassical.org. And this program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's Coffee Shop is open every day at East Burnside and 8th Avenue.
I can see the Christmas tree the way it used to be. I can't wait to hear the dinner bell. Oh, how I long for my corn pone and turkey and the pies that my mom would bake for me. I'm going home for an old-timey Christmas.